danger to the people of one's own tribe, especially in the context of war with another tribe. Aristotle's most noble form of courage was a willingness to take a necessary risk to ensure the survival of the group, a demonstration of the willingness to risk one's own being for the gang proves loyalty and increases a man's value to the gang. When the chips are down, a man who shows this kind of courage can be counted on to give everything he has, even sacrificing himself, for the survival of the group. When a group is not facing a survival challenge, that group can afford to be metaphorical about courage and acknowledge lesser sacrifices. Until security is established, though, no group can afford to bother with niceties like intellectual courage. The word courage is used cheaply today. Any celebrity who gets sick and doesn't spend every day crying about it is lauded by the tabloids for his or her courageous battle with cancer or chronic fatigue syndrome or depression or even food addiction. There's nothing wrong with acknowledging the difficulties others face, but we can also acknowledge, as Aristotle and the Romans did, that courage, in its highest and purest form, involves the willful risk of bodily harm or death for the good of the group. Lesser risks require greater dilutions of courage. Aristotle believed that heroic courage was the noblest form of moral courage, but he also noted that passion, spiritedness, was something akin to courage. In Plato's Republic, it is suggested that savage cruelty comes from the same part of a man that inspires great acts of courage. Courage was a trained, mature, socially aware, and cooperative form of spirit. Translator Alan Bloom identified the raw form of courage, thumos, or spiritedness, as the principal seat of anger or rage. Socrates likened the guardians of his city to noble puppies who would be gentle with the people they knew, but be eager to fight ferociously against strangers and outsiders when necessary. To get at the essence of what masculinity really is, let's remove the gilding of morality and nobility for a moment. While I do believe that some men demonstrate heroic tendencies at an almost instinctive level, like noble puppies, I will also say that before a man can be willing to take a risk for the group, he must be willing to take risks generally. Some men and women are described as being risk-averse and will go out of their way to avoid almost any kind of risk at all. Before we can have a willingness to take risks for the group, call that high courage, we must also possess some kind of low courage that amounts to a comfort with risk-taking. Risk-taking comes more naturally to some than to others, and it comes more naturally to men than it does to women. As strength is trainable, so is courage. But like strength, some have a greater aptitude for risk-taking than others. Males socialize each other, hell, they taunt and goad each other gleefully into taking risks. When there is no heroic objective in sight, boys will dare each other to do all sorts of stupid things. However, a male who is comfortable with low risk-taking is likely going to be surer of himself and more successful when the time comes to take a heroic risk. When answering the question, what is masculinity, it is also important to keep sight of the individual within the group. Heroic courage benefits the group, but as we have discussed, there are benefits to gaining status within the group, and men will fight for that status. This requires a less noble kind of courage. It requires a spiritedness on one's own behalf. The strength of man is not merely a tool to be used in the service of others. Men also use strength to advance their own interests, and it is foolish to expect them to make endless sacrifices without personal gain of some kind, be it material or spiritual. We should expect men to fight for themselves, to compete with one another, and to look after their own interests. Nothing could be more natural than a man who wants to triumph and prosper. It is not the strongest man who will necessarily lead. It is the man who takes the lead who will lead. This intragroup courage is required for a man to assert his interests over the interests of other men within the group. At the most primal level, asserting your interests over the interests of another man requires a potential threat of violence. This is how men have always sized each other up, and this is how they size each other up today. This base, amoral, courageous spirit is required to move ahead of other men within a hierarchy. It's the essence of competitive spirit. Nose to nose, men still look each other over and try to perceive whether, and to what extent, another man would be willing to press his interests. If I push, will he give way? Will he push back? This basic push is the spark of courage. If it isn't sufficiently present in a man, I highly doubt higher forms of courage would even be possible. There are many names for the kind of courage required to take risks to advance one's own interests. Most people would call it balls. Another word is gameness. Sam Sheridan wrote about it in A Fighter's Heart. Gameness is a term used in dogfighting to describe the eagerness to get into the fight, the berserker rage, and then the absolute commitment to the fight in the face of pain, of disfigurement, until death. In dogfighting, two dogs will fight until they are broken up for some reason. The dogs will be pulled back behind scratch lines in their corners and then released. Dogs who jump back into the fight, this is called making scratch, are said to be game. Dogfighting is a test of this gameness. According to Sheridan, dogfighting is not meant to be a fight to the death. The dogs fight until one of them refuses to cross the scratch lines and continue the fight. It's like tapping out, or saying, "Uncle." Men evaluate each other for gameness, and this is the reason it was relevant in Sheridan's book about amateur and professional fighting. This indomitable spirit is a major theme in every heroic journey. In sports, it's part of the comeback tale. A guy faces his toughest challenge, and then, when all but a few have counted him out, he comes back, running on pure heart, and triumphs over his opponent. It's the climax of every Rocky story, and it was a gimmick in most of Hulk Hogan's professional wrestling matches. In every Die Hard movie, John McClane managed to save the day only after he's been beaten and bruised and comes back from the brink of defeat. These heroes have a push inside them that keeps them coming back again and again after others would have given up. A man who is obviously game can step ahead of a man who is not, simply because he can expect the man who is less game to yield to him. Some people talk about masculinity by attempting to determine who is alpha and who is beta in a given situation. A good friend put it to me this way. If you can treat another man like he's your kid brother, you are the alpha. The alpha will be the man with more push, and he will push ahead of the beta. Feigning gameness can be an effective strategy, so long as no one calls your bluff. Gameness can be feigned through body language, through vocal inflection, and through word choice. Creating a sense that you are ready to push as hard as necessary to get what you want is a way to establish authority, whether you're a prisoner, a businessman, a law enforcement professional, a parent, or someone trying to discipline a dog. Most people will not test someone who is feigning gameness if the actor is convincing enough. Feigning gameness is a means of asserting one's will, and people do it all the time, even in primitive societies. Failed attempts to feign gameness, trying to look tougher than you are and not pulling it off, are what feminists point to when they talk about performing masculinity, or putting on a tough guise. What they are recognizing is the fact that men today still go through the ritual of establishing hierarchies and sizing each other up, even though most are untested and few will ever fight. It can seem silly to watch, precisely because it is divorced from the deadly serious tactical reality of a survival scenario. Feigning gameness can also unfortunately lead to delusional behavior. Many people affect the attitudes and the postures of violence even though they have no experience with or expectation of physical violence. There is a fearlessness that comes with knowing that you can say whatever you want because there is a large, heavily armed man standing behind you. People can talk tough without having to do the primitive math of violence because they believe that law enforcement will either intervene and stop or punish an attacker. Delusional gameness relies on the deterrent of men and women who are prepared to use violence to enforce the law. Delusional gameness is only possible when there is almost no danger of violent escalation. In less secure, less luxurious times and places, assertiveness must be accompanied by physical courage and daring. When there is no expectation that you will be saved, or that most people fear the violent retribution of the state, it is foolish to provoke a dangerous-looking man unless you are prepared to fight him. The raw courage of gameness may correlate with the surety of greater size and strength to some degree, but many smaller men are as game or more game than their larger counterparts. Flyweight fighters are a good example of men who are extremely game, though they are far less strong than many larger men who are less game. Weight class combat sports show that men of all sizes can demonstrate terrific gameness. Both men and women can be game, but status for human females has rarely depended on a woman's willingness to fight. Demure, polite, passive women are attractive to men and are generally well-liked by other women. Even today, many men will jump at the opportunity to harm a man who harms a female stranger. Because of this, many women can be assertive or make displays of gameness with relative impunity, and some become delusional about their ability to make good on their threats or defend themselves if their taunts result in violence. Gravitas is another old word that we still use to talk about manliness, especially in actors or politicians. We say a man possesses gravitas when he makes us believe we should take him seriously. We get our word gravity from the Latin gravitas. It means heavy. The Romans used gravitas the same way we do, to say that a man or a thing is to be taken seriously. Contrasted with the frenzied imagery of a game pit bull, it balances out our sense of what manly courage is. Courage is not only the desire to leap into battle or move up in a hierarchy, it is also about defending position. Masculine men make it clear that they are to be taken seriously, that they have weight, that they won't just be pushed around. Men want other men to know that they will be heavy to move and must be taken seriously. Courage is the animating spirit of masculinity, and it is crucial to any meaningful definition of masculinity. Courage and strength are synergetic virtues. An overabundance of one is worth less without an adequate amount of the other. In any gang of men fighting for survival, courage will be esteemed and respected in the living, and it will be revered in the dead. Courage is a crucial tactical value. One can choose to be courageous, and even in its basest form, courage is a triumph over fear. It's associated with heart and spirit and passion, but it is also a drive to fight and win. Courage is abstract, and it has many aspects, so I have summarized its definition as it relates to our attempt to understand the way of men and the gang ethos. Courage is the will to risk harm in order to benefit oneself or others. in its most basic amoral form. Courage is a willingness or passionate desire to fight or hold ground at any cost. Gameness, heart, spirit, thumos. In its most developed, civilized, and moral form, courage is the considered and decisive willingness to risk harm to ensure the success or survival of a group or another person. Courage, virtus, Andrea. Comparing his own experiences as a fighter to watching dogs fight, Sam Sheridan wrote, quote, "They writhe furiously, like snakes, twisting and spitting and slavering, growling like bears. Fury epitomized. Their tails are wagging. And this is what they are meant to do. And they're fulfilling their purpose, their becoming. There is blood, but the dogs don't care. Turning and pinning, fighting off their backs and then clawing their way to standing. Any pain they feel is overwhelmed by the desire to get the other dog. I know that feeling." End quote. Plato, or Socrates, also compared men to dogs. One of the great tragedies of modernity is the lack of opportunity for men to become what they are, to do what they were bred to do, what their bodies want to do. They could be Plato's noble puppies, but they are chained to a stake in the ground, left to the madness of barking at shadows in the night, taunted by passing challenges left unresolved, and whose outcomes will forever be unknown. Mastery. Men have always recognized themselves in animals. They have worshipped animals and claimed totemic lineage from animals. Men have traced their origins to gods who were like animals, part animal, or who could change into animals. Heracles was depicted wearing the skin of a powerful lion he killed. Norse berserkers wore the skins of wolves and bears to intimidate their enemies and inspire ferocious courage in battle. In the Aztec military, it was the elite jaguar warriors who went to the front. Military units and sports teams around the world adopt the names of formidable animals to represent their own gameness and strength. Throughout this book, I have compared men to dogs and to chimpanzees. However, in sport and in war and in life, there is another manly virtue that is universally and specifically human because, for the most part, it requires human intellect. Animals succeed or fail largely due to a combination of their circumstances and their inborn genetic fitness for a given situation. An animal who is stronger, nimbler, or more game will triumph over an inferior animal. We have to project our own humanity onto animals to make them masters of strategy. In all but the most intelligent animals like higher primates or orca or dolphins, what we read as a skill is most often instinct, not the product of thinking or tinkering or trial and error. The desire and ability to use reason and to develop skills and technologies that allow one to gain mastery over one's circumstances, over oneself, over nature, over other men, over women, is a human virtue, although it is also man's Achilles heel. If you ask men what it means to be good at being a man, you'll often get answers that start to sound like a set of minimum skill proficiencies in a job description. While the job description for men undeniably changes according to time, place, and culture, the primitive gang virtue that unifies them all is being able to carry your own weight. Women are more comfortable with accepting the benevolent aid of the group because they have always required it. A healthy adult woman must accept aid from the group if she is to carry a child, give birth, and care for an infant. And especially when men have achieved a level of security and prosperity beyond mere survival. Women have been evaluated by men based less on their utility than on more nebulous qualities like attractiveness and social charm. When they have the means, most men will happily support a woman who seems to be carefree, pretty, and charming. This has not been the case with men. It is far rarer for women or men to volunteer to support a grown, able-bodied man. It is rarer still for them to support him without resentment. There is no point in an adult male's life when he can be excused from carrying his own weight, except when he is sick, injured, handicapped, or old. Human societies accommodate all of these exceptions, but competency has always been crucial to a man's mental health and sense of his own worth. Men want to carry their own weight, and they should be expected to. As Don Corleone might put it, women and children could afford to be careless for most of human history. But not men. Men have always had to demonstrate to the group that they could carry their own weight. Until you can function as a competent member of the group and carry your own weight, you are a supplicant and a drag on the collective. A child is a child, but an incompetent adult is a beggar. One of the problems with massive welfare states is that they make children or beggars of us all, and as such are an affront and a barrier to adult masculinity. It has become cliched comedy for men and women to laugh at men who are concerned with being competent. The "men refuse to stop and ask for directions" joke never seems to get old for women who are more comfortable with dependents or socialist types, because reducing men to a childlike state of supplication and submission to state bureaucrats is required for big government welfare states to function. Masculine loathing of dependence is a bulwark to the therapeutic mother state. Dependency is powerlessness, yet men have always been cooperative hunters, and in a survival scenario, they will fall into hierarchies based on strength and gameness. Men have a certain natural comfort with interdependency. Claims of complete independence are generally bullshit. Few of us have ever survived, or would be able to survive, on our own for an extended period of time. Few of us would want to. A child is completely dependent and powerless. It has no control over its own fate. Controlling one's own fate within the context of group give and take has to do with figuring out what you bring to the table and making yourself valuable to the group. The bare minimum required for moving from dependence to interdependence is competence and self-sufficiency, the ability to carry one's own weight. Becoming an interdependent, rather than completely dependent, member of the group means mastering a set of useful skills and understanding some useful ideas. We send children to school to master a set of skills and a body of knowledge that we think they'll need to carry their own weight in society and function as adults. Most militaries send men to boot camp. At boot camp, men learn a basic skill set and a body of knowledge necessary to function within the military. Boot camp graduates can theoretically be expected to at least carry their own weight in an offensive or defensive scenario. Understanding the way of men means understanding how men evaluate each other as men and how they accord status to men within the context of a primal history common to all men. The amoral masculine gang ethos is tactical and utilitarian. It's kind of like picking men for a sports team. Before people care about whether or not you're a good person, they want to know if you're a good player. Speculating about the morality of professional athletes is a popular form of male social gossip, but when the athletes take the field, what matters most is how they can contribute to a team's success. Men want to know if they have the physical ability, the gameness, and the mastery of the skills necessary to help the team win. The way of men, the gang ethos, and the amoral tactical virtues are fundamentally about winning. Before you can have church and art and philosophy, you need to be able to survive. You need to triumph over nature and other men, or at the very least, you need to be able to keep both at bay. Winning requires strength and courage, and it requires sufficient mastery of the skills required to win. Stated as a manly virtue, mastery is a man's desire and ability to cultivate and demonstrate proficiency and expertise in techniques that aid in the exertions of will over himself, over nature, over women, and over other men. Advanced levels of mastery and techniques allow men to compete for improved status within the group by bringing more to the camp, hunt, or fight than their bodies would otherwise allow. Mastery can be supplementary. A man who can build, hunt, and fight, but who can also do something else well, be it telling jokes, or setting traps, or making blades, is worth more to the group and is likely to have a higher status within the group than a man who can merely build, hunt, and fight well. Mastery can also be a compensatory virtue, in the sense that a weaker or less courageous man can earn the esteem of his peers by providing something else of great value. It could well have been a runt who tamed fire, or invented the crossbow, or played the first music, and such a man would have earned the respect and admiration of his peers. Homer was a blind man, but his words have been valued by men for thousands of years. Women also earn their keep through mastery of one kind or another, and mastery is by no means exclusive to men, but mastery does have a lot to do with competition for status between men. If necessity is the mother of invention, it is the need to compete for status and peer esteem, to find a valued place in the group, that drives many inventors to invent. The drive to gain control over something is part of the drive to master nature. Strength, courage, and honor make a tidy triad because they are all directly concerned with violence. But the picture of how men judge men as men is incomplete without some concept of mastery. Strength, gameness, and competition for status are all present in animals. But it is the conscious drive to master our world that differentiates men from beasts. Whether you're a benevolent king or a ruthless gangster, a man with a special skill, talent, or technology can be as valuable or exponentially more valuable than your toughest thug. It is mastery, more often than brute strength, that allows the elite to rule. Masculinity can never be separated from its connection to violence, because it is through violence that we ultimately compete for status and wield power over other men. However, mastered skills and technology provide deciding advantages in fighting, hunting, and surviving for human men.
Honor.
The idea of honor shines an ancient light so warm and golden that almost everyone wants to stand in it. This is the most natural desire in the world because honor in its most inclusive sense is esteem, respect, and status. To be honored is to be respected by one's peers. Thomas Hobbes wrote in Leviathan that what was honorable was whatsoever possession, action, or quality is an argument and a sign of power. Hobbes believed that honor existed in a free market, where value was accorded to men based on what men had to offer and the value that other men placed on it. For Hobbes, honor was a form of deference, an acknowledgement of power and influence over other men. In our rudimentary gang of a few men depending on each other in a hostile environment, this definition of honor is directly related to the other three masculine virtues. In a hostile environment, strength, courage, and mastery are all absolutely necessary for survival, and everyone in the gang understands this to be true because external threats are regular and imminent. Men who exhibit these traits will have greater value to the group and contribute more to the group's survival and prosperity. Deference acknowledges interdependency and loyalty. In a relatively secure society, while power ultimately comes from the ability to use violence, there are so many middlemen involved that the person who wields the most power and influence may simply be the person with the most wealth or popularity. For instance, teen singing stars and talk show hosts can wield tremendous power and influence, but their power has little or nothing to do with the esteem of the fighting men who gave the word honor its heroic glow. According to author James Bowman, there are two types of honor. Reflexive honor is the primitive desire to hit back when hit, to show that you will stand up for yourself. To expand on Bowman's theory, reflexive honor is the signal of the rattlesnake, communicating a reputation for retaliation, summed up by the popular old motto, Nemo me impune lacessit, or no one attacks me with impunity. To protect one's honor is as defensive as it is offensive, even if attack is preemptive, as it often is. People are more likely to leave you alone if they fear harm from you, and if men give way to you because they fear you, you will gain a certain status among men. This is equally true for a group, and in a survival scenario, it is generally a tactical advantage to appear to be fearsome. That is, it is tactically advantageous to cultivate a reputation for strength, a willingness to fight, and for technical mastery. A man once said, "If I allow a man to steal my chickens, I might as well let him rape my daughters." That's reflexive honor. Bowman also recognized the idea of cultural honor, which he defined as a sum of the traditions, stories, and habits of thought of a particular society about the proper and improper uses of violence. Bowman's definition of cultural honor has a moral cast to it. While Bowman links it to violence above, he notes throughout his book that there is a conflict, especially but not uniquely, in the Western mind between manly public honor and private moral honor that has as much to do with one's personal philosophy and a desire to be a good person as it does with one's reputation for violent retaliation in the eyes of men. While Bowman's view of cultural honor follows from reflexive honor, cultural honor is ultimately concerned with being a good man, not being good at being a man. Because it is linked to morality and what is valued culturally, the cultural code of honor can morph into virtually anything. We see this in the way the blood is wiped from the blade of honor today. Honor is used to indicate almost any sort of general esteem, deference, or respect. School recognition programs like the National Honor Society continue the meritocratic, hierarchical sense of honor, because study is an attempt at mastery, however gender-neutral and nonviolent. The deference that Hobbes recognized in honor is now applied to abstract concepts that have little or nothing to do with traditional honor. For instance, the slogan, "Honor Diversity," is popular with gay rights advocates who reject traditional, hierarchical ways of defining both honor and masculinity. Honor diversity is an interesting slogan because it essentially means honor everyone and everything. If everyone is honored equally, and everyone's way of life is honored equally, honor has no hierarchy, and therefore honor has little value according to the economics of supply and demand. Honor diversity doesn't mean much more than be nice. If honor is to mean anything at all, it must be hierarchical. To be honored, as Hobbes recognized, is to be esteemed. And as humans are differently abled and differently motivated, some will earn greater esteem than others. Americans have a strained relationship with the idea of honor. They've always been a little drunk on the idea that all men are created equal, And politicians have spent 2 centuries flattering every Joe Schmo into thinking his opinion is worth just as much as anyone else's, even when he has absolutely no idea what he's talking about. American men profess the creed of equality, but if you put a bunch of American men in a room, or give them a job to do, they work out their Lord of the Flies hierarchies in the same way that men always have. The religion of equality gives way to the reality of meritocracy, and there's not too great a leap between Geoffroy de Charny's motto, "Who does more is worth more," and the rugged individualism of the American who was expected to pull himself up by his own bootstraps. To honor a man is to acknowledge his accomplishments and recognize that he has attained a higher status within a group. If we stop there and say that honor is merely high group status, we still have a definition of honor that would be unrecognizable to the knights, the samurai, the ancient Greeks, and the ancient Romans who, among many others, give the idea of honor the noble, mythic quality that makes it so appealing. The reason for this is simple. Honor has always been about the esteem of groups of men. It probably never occurred to Hobbes to include this caveat, because despite the occasional female monarch, he lived his entire life in a system designed to favor male interests. The thought of a system where females had an equal say has been unthinkable to all but a few before our time. Men have always ruled, and men have always determined what behaviors were honored and what behaviors were considered dishonorable. And while the specifics of these honor codes have changed as circumstances and prevailing moralities changed, the majority of men still acknowledged the fundamental tactical necessity of reflexive honor. They still judged each other as men, according to the basic masculine virtues of strength, courage, and mastery. When the word honor is connected to the word culture and framed as a negative, social scientists seem to be more comfortable with a definition of honor similar to the one I'm presenting here. Recently, an article linking a higher rate of accidental death in males to risk-taking and honor culture in southern states received attention from mainstream news outlets. The researchers in question defined this honor culture according to cultural emphasis on, quote, "the relentless and sometimes violent defense of masculine reputation, which is presumably a social adaptation to an environment characterized by scarce resources, frequent intergroup aggression, e.g. raiding, and the absence of the rule of law," end quote. They hypothesized that men from honor cultures would be more likely to engage in risky behaviors because, quote, "risky behaviors provide social proof of strength and fearlessness," end quote. While the study revealed the biases of its authors by focusing on the white honor culture of southern Ulster Scots and avoiding any discussion of honor cultures among Latino prison gangs, African warlords, or Islamic terrorists, the researchers seem to agree that honor among men tends to be defined by a concern with maintaining a reputation for strength and courage, 2 of our other 3 masculine virtues. Bowman and others have written that, quote, "honor depends on the honor group," end quote. The honor group is the male gang, and honor cultures are about status within a given gang of men. What the sociologists were essentially saying in their study of honor states is that some men care more about what other men think of them, specifically their reputation for strength, honor, and mastery, than others. Honor groups depend on a sense of shared identity. In a cosmopolitan scenario, where frequent travel, fleeting connections, and temporary alliances are the norm, the us versus them never quite take shape on the direct interpersonal level. Instead, the honor group is ritualized, or metaphorical, as with sports teams and political parties and ideological positions. These allegiances can be abandoned easily, and personal accountability is minimal. Honor relies on face-to-face connections and the possibility of shame or dishonor in the eyes of other men. This partially explains why men who have grown up together in the same ghetto block or the same rural area, or who have spent time bunked together, will be more likely to be concerned with honor than more mobile men who travel a lot, or men who only spend time with other men in the presence of females. As it relates to understanding the masculine ethos, honor is a man's reputation for strength, courage, and mastery within the context of an honor group comprised primarily of men. Stated as a masculine virtue, honor is a man's reputation for strength, courage, and mastery within the context of an honor group comprised primarily of other men. Stated as a masculine virtue, honor is a concern for one's reputation for strength, courage, and mastery within the context of an honor group comprised primarily of other men. There are moral codes and cultural codes of honor that factor into men's estimation of the men within their honor groups, but the point here is to reduce masculinity to first principles without getting lost in a morass of variable cultural honor codes. What is common to the honor of the mafioso and the honor of the knight, to the honor of American founding father Alexander Hamilton, and the honor of any naked savage is a concern for one's reputation as a man of strength, courage, and mastery, and how it relates to a man's sense of worthiness and belonging within the context of a male honor group. Understanding dishonor. Part of the reason that honor is a virtue, rather than merely a state of affairs, is that showing concern for the respect of your peers is a show of loyalty and indication of belonging, of being us rather than them. It is a show of deference. Hobbes noted that men honored each other by seeking each other's counsel and by imitating each other. Caring about what the men around you think of you is a show of respect, and conversely, not caring what the other men think of you is a sign of disrespect. In a survival band, it is tactically advantageous to maintain a reputation for being strong, courageous, and masterful as a group. A man who does not care for his own reputation makes his team look weak by association. Dishonor and disregard for honor are dangerous for a survival band or a fighting team because the appearance of weakness invites attack. At the personal, intergroup level, the appearance of weakness or submissiveness invites other men to assert their interests over your own. The tactical problems presented by the appearance of weakness as a group explain, to some extent, the visceral response many men have to displays of flamboyant effeminacy. The word effeminacy is a bit misleading here, because this really isn't about women. The dislike of what is commonly called effeminacy is about male status anxiety and practical concerns about tactical vulnerabilities, and it is more accurate to discuss dishonor in terms of deficient masculinity and flamboyant dishonor. Deficient masculinity is simply a lack of strength, courage, or mastery. Because masculinity and honor are by nature hierarchical, all men are in some way deficient in masculinity compared to a higher status man. There is always a higher status man. If not in your group, then in another, and if not in this way, then in that way, and if not now, then eventually. No one is the strongest, most courageous, and the smartest or most masterful man, though some men are closer to the ideal or perfect form of masculinity than others. Masculinity, in the perfect ideal, is aspirational, not attainable. The point is to be better, stronger, more courageous, more masterful, to achieve greater honor. The men who possess the least of these qualities, or suffer from an excessive lack of one in particular, are the men who other men don't want to be. They are furthest from the ideal. So long as they don't openly despise the ideal, or attempt to move the goalpost to appear more masculine by creating some new artificial standard, men will tend to include and help members of their gang or tribe who are unusually deficient in strength, courage, or mastery. The lowest status men within a group are still usually included in the group unless they bring shame to the group as a whole, thus endangering the group, at least in theory, or fail so miserably that they become an excessive burden. Most high-status men are not monsters, and most low-status men don't want to be a burden on others, because dependency is slavery. So, men who are not good at being men generally try to find some way to make themselves useful, or at least tolerable, to a given group of men. Think of the funny fat guys, and the frail artists, and the nurturing fellows who make sure everything is in order for the men of action. All large groups of men seem to have members who assume these kinds of low-status roles while remaining part of the honor group. Deficient masculinity is undesirable and results in low status. Men despise deficient masculinity in themselves because they would naturally rather be stronger, more courageous, and more masterful. Deficient masculinity rarely arouses hate or anger within a male group, though it may result in some general frustration. Flamboyant dishonor. Deficient masculinity is trying and failing. Failure is part of trying, and while men tease and goad each other, no man who has become masterful at anything has achieved that mastery without a certain amount of failure along the way. Male groups are hierarchical, so while greater dominance is desirable, a certain amount of submission is essential to any cooperative group of men. Unless some men give way to others, you'll end up with too many chiefs and not enough Indians. Honor as a virtue means caring about what other men think of you, trying to earn their esteem, and asserting yourself as best you can to achieve the highest relative position within the group. Flamboyant dishonor is not a failure of strength or courage. Men who are flamboyantly dishonorable are flagrant in their disregard for the esteem of their male peers. What we often call effeminacy is a theatrical rejection of the masculine hierarchy and manly virtues. Masculinity is religious, and flamboyantly dishonorable men are blasphemers. Flamboyant dishonor is an insult to the core values of the male group. Flamboyant dishonor is an openly expressed lack of concern for one's reputation for strength, courage, and mastery within the context of an honor group comprised primarily of other men. In 1994, Michael Kimmel wrote an essay which provocatively asserted that, quote, "Homophobia is a central organizing principle of our cultural definition of manhood," end quote. He went on to clarify that this homophobia had little or nothing to do with homosexual acts or an actual fear of homosexuals. He wrote, quote, "Homophobia is the fear that other men will unmask us, emasculate us, reveal to the world that we do not measure up, that we are not real men. We are afraid to let other men see that fear." End quote. Why call it homophobia? The kind of masculine status anxiety Kimmel wrote about has as much to do with the way men fumble to translate the honor of the small, bonded male gang into a complex modern society full of mixed messages and overlapping male groups. This fear is the fear of the unknown. In an established, tightly bonded male group, men know about where they stand in the hierarchy. There's nowhere to hide, so there is less fear of being revealed as a fraud. And like some kinds of primal sports ranking system, men are constantly tested against one another and against external forces. I've observed this in the few brief introductions I've had to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in gyms where everyone rolls with everyone. Men quickly find out who is good and who isn't. There is no hiding or pretending, and it doesn't matter whether or not your internet profile picture looks tough or if you put on a good show, because here is this guy who is choking you out. You are revealed as what you are, and all that remains is to improve. The only way you can increase your status within the group is to try harder and get better. Flamboyant dishonor is a little bit like walking into that room full of men who are trying to get better at jiu-jitsu and insisting that they stop what they are doing and pay attention to your fantastic new tap dancing routine. The flamboyantly dishonorable man seeks attention for something the male group doesn't value or which isn't appropriate at a given time. At the primal level, flamboyant dishonor presents tactical problems for the group. By outwardly and theatrically rejecting the core masculine values, particularly strength and courage, the flamboyantly dishonorable male advertises weakness and a propensity for submission to outside watchers. Any honest student of human, and in many cases primate, body language will be forced to recognize that the postures, gestures, and intonations of males generally regarded as effeminate are in fact postures, gestures, and intonations that communicate submissiveness. Humans are complicated, and when push comes to shove, stereotypically effeminate males are not always as submissive as their body language would seem to indicate. However, submissiveness is what they advertise. This submissiveness correlates with male homosexuality, and the problems most men have with male homosexuality, aside from concerns about unsolicited advances, are mostly related to the perception of an overwillingness to submit to other men. There are extremely submissive or flamboyantly dishonorable effeminate heterosexual men. Kimmel, for instance, is heterosexual but flamboyantly dishonorable. His wrists are limp, his gestures are airy, his demeanor is precious, and he has devoted his entire career to the open rejection of the manly virtues and a persistent devaluing of male honor codes. I do not need to insult him. None of these qualities are negative, according to his own views, and I am certain he is proud of his own life's work. He is a perfect example of a heterosexual male who flagrantly rejects the gang virtues of strength, courage, mastery, and honor. The man who flamboyantly rejects the honor codes of the group can obviously not be trusted to snap to in a state of emergency. Dishonor is disloyalty. A man who not only openly refuses to strive to be as strong, courageous, and competent as he can, but who flaunts these codes theatrically, is for all to see a weak link. He makes his peers seem more vulnerable for tolerating vulnerability, and more cowardly for tolerating cowardice. He brings shame on the group, and with shame comes danger, because public displays of weakness and cowardice invite attack. This tactical reasoning goes a long way toward explaining why men who function successfully within male honor groups make a big show of rejecting and distancing themselves from males who are flamboyantly dishonorable. By expelling effeminate males from the gang, or by shaming them, or pushing them to the fringes of a particular group, the group projects strength and unity. The group demonstrates that we do not tolerate unmanly men here. The shunning of homosexuals and perceived homosexuals is generally justified with appeals to divine or natural laws. That spin that absolves men of responsibility for social cruelty to members of their own tribe. When men reject effeminate men, they are rejecting weakness, casting it out, and cleansing themselves of its corrosive stigma. In many societies that have openly tolerated effeminacy, flamboyantly effeminate males have been relegated to a half-man, half-woman status and given a special role. The Native American Burdaki, for example, were regarded as neither man nor woman. They were usually men. They dressed differently to distinguish themselves from men. They generally did what was considered woman's work within the village, and they were often regarded as serving a mediating role between men and women. Indian hijras are another example of a flamboyantly dishonorable, or gender nonconforming, if you prefer the feminist lingo, males who are accepted in society so long as they accept a special gender status and exist apart from normal men. Honor is a powerful concept because it is connected to every man's primal need to demonstrate that he is of value to the group, that he is more of an asset than a liability. Women have a separate value to men that has nothing to do with their ability to demonstrate strength, courage, or mastery. Men who are deficient or handicapped in some way can deliver value in other ways. Most men care about being seen by other men as being strong, courageous, and competent because these tactical virtues have been essential to their role as men and their very survival for most of human history. In a war or in an emergency, these virtues would still be of primary importance, and all other virtues would be comparatively incidental. In less dire times, as opportunities for men to demonstrate the tactical virtues decrease, honor broadens its scope. Men still struggle to show other men that they are worthy. They still struggle to show that they are worth having around, worthy of belonging to the group, a valued member of us. When there is less hunting and fighting to do, men attempt to increase their value to other men by showing that they are good people or good citizens, good members of the tribe. They try to show that they are good men. Earning and keeping a reputation as a good man overlaps conceptually with honor because it is another way to add value and show worth to other men. Honor as a virtue is a demonstration of group loyalty, so it naturally expands to include other demonstrations of loyalty to the values of the group, from piously praising the tribal gods to standing up for what is right according to the group's ethical codes. Still, honor at its root is about showing men that you are good at being a man and good at filling man's first role on the perimeter. Showing other men that you are a good man is an outgrowth of that. Being a good man is related to honor, but it is not the root of honor. We care what other men think of us, first and foremost, because men have always depended on each other to survive. It is triumph over nature and triumph over other men. It is survival and prosperity and life itself that give honor the golden glow which draws men to it and repels them from dishonor. On being a good man. Quote, "We see men of all kinds of professed creeds attain to almost all degrees of worth or worthlessness under any of them.